This morning I want to finish up Pastor Wagner's practical tips on money management. I have two more rules, so-called, to go over, and then I want to get into Dave Ramsey's seven baby steps. And then, Lord willing, next Sunday we will conclude this series after eight long months, is my hope anyway. So, rule number six. These are my rules, which are actually not rules. These are just suggestions. But this is a rule for my own life anyway. It's worked out really well for me, as have the rest of these things. And that is, when you get a raise or your income increases, spend the same amount of money as before and save the rest. And if you do that from a young age, things are go very well for you financially. When you get a raise, you don't want to change your spending habits. Now, this is what virtually everybody does. Nearly every person in this country, not every, but the vast majority of them, as soon as they get a raise, their spending then increases proportionate to that raise. But you don't want to do that. You rather want to save that money proportionally in your different accounts. You remember the last couple of sermons when I talked about all the different accounts that you have set up, the different funds? Well, that's when you get a raise, you just proportionally put more in those accounts. If you need to put more in those accounts, some of them have a set amount. You don't need to put any more in them, but some of those accounts, you just put more in there, and you just save the rest. What most people do, if they had any of those accounts set up, would be, if I got a $1,000 raise per month, that $1,000 after taxes goes in the fund money account, and I blow it all. That's what most people do when they get the raise. It's just gone, and they may as well have not gotten the raise because it didn't make any difference whatsoever. But this is something that I've done my entire life. For the last 25 years, since I was 18 years old, this is precisely what I've done. Every time I got a raise and made more money, I just saved the extra money that I made and, you know, and I mean, proportionally gave to the Lord and all that stuff, but I didn't change my standard of living. I didn't change, you know, how much I went out to eat, how much fun I had, what kind of cars I bought, any of that stuff. I just lived like I always had lived and just saved the rest. Only until very recently have I just begun to enjoy some of the fruit of my labor, probably more like a normal person would. But that's after 25 years of doing this. If you start this as soon as you get your first job, which this wouldn't apply to any of us except for Braden, but if you start this as soon as you get your first job, you will not be a lifelong debt slave like the rest of the serfs in our society. But it's important to start young. Now, you don't have to do this your whole life, right? There's no reason to be at the end of your life and still living on the exact same budget you did when you were 18 or something. But you do this until you get to a certain point in life where all your debts are gone, you've got your fully funded emergency fund, you're investing, you have money laid up for retirement, you've paid off your house, all those kind of things. And then you can start to lighten up, and then you can start to enjoy some of the fruit of your labor, and you don't need to save every penny, you know, that you make. And if you get a raise, you can enjoy some more of that raise, right? You don't need to save it all at that point. So like I said, after you've paid off all your debt, you have a fully funded 3 to 6 month emergency fund, you're giving generously, you're investing 15% of your gross income into retirement accounts, then you can move from being intense to intentional, and you can start to enjoy some of your money. Now, almost all of our countrymen do it just the opposite. They enjoy all their money, they blow it all, the whole, you know, throughout their entire youth, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever, and then all of a sudden, they're like, oh man, I am whatever, in my 60s or my 50s, and I don't have any money saved, and I got a pile of debt, and now I need to get busy. And instead of being able to enjoy those latter years, now it's like time to tighten the belt and not enjoy the latter years. You had all the fun in the beginning, and I'd personally rather have the fun at the end. And you say, well, what if you never make it to the end? Yeah, big deal. I don't care. I'm going to heaven. So you never got to enjoy some of the fruit of your labor on earth? Who cares, right? Doesn't matter to me. No, I'm not saying you do that up until like the day before you die. I'm just saying you do it up until the point where you're at that point, and then you can start to live like no other, like Dave Ramsey says. And then after your house is paid off and you're doing all the above mentioned things, then you can enjoy even more of your money. Right? So you do those things intensely until you get to that point where you have nothing left but the house. Then you can back off a little bit and start to lighten up and enjoy yourself a little bit, but still working to get that house paid off ahead of time. But then when you get the house paid off, you know, then, like Ramsey says, if you live like no one else, later you can live and give like no one else. Now, as I mentioned, fools do the opposite of this. When fools get a raise, they immediately spend the extra money that they have left each month, or that they have each month. Now, Proverbs 21 and verse 20. I've been back to this verse a number of times. There is treasure to be desired and oil in the dwelling of the wise, but a foolish man spendeth it up. See, fools increase their standard of living, and they save no more than they did previously. So if a fool makes $3,000 a month and he gets a raise to $4,000 a month, he doesn't save $1,000 a month or whatever would be left after taxes and giving and all that. He doesn't save that. He just spends all that extra money. So he has the exact same amount of savings he did per month when he was making $1,000 less. He saves the exact same amount. He just blows the rest. And obviously, he doesn't have to blow the rest because he was living on $3,000 before he got the $1,000 raise, so he could still be living on $3,000. And this is why fools never end up building wealth. And this is why they'll be broke debt slaves their entire lives. This is what I call the broke man mindset. And this is why there are many people, and I've given you statistics already in this series, this is why there are many people that make six figures in this country and yet live paycheck to paycheck. Many, I forget what the percentage was, but it's a high percentage of people who make six figures or more and still live paycheck to paycheck. You know why? They didn't always make six figures. They made half that or a third of that. And as they kept making and making more money, guess what? They kept spending and spending more money. So now they make six figures and they still are paycheck to paycheck. And they'll be broke the rest of their lives unless they change their ways. When a wise man gets a raise or an increase of income, he'll save the extra money and spend the same as before. See, wise men, their standard of living doesn't change at all or very little as they make more money, at least until they get, you know, to that point that I talked about. They therefore build wealth. And it's important, if you build wealth in your youth, time and interest are on your side. It's a lot easier. You have to save way less money in the long run if you start when you're younger. You realize that, right? If you start when you're younger, you could save a fraction of the amount of money that you did if you started when you're older and end up with the same amount of money at retirement. You know that, right? Right? It just makes way more sense to do it when you're younger, but nobody wants to do that because everybody wants to have fun. Everybody wants to have instant gratification. Now, if wise people's income goes down for some reason, it's no big deal to them, because they've been living way below their means to start with. So it's not a catastrophe. If something happens, you lose your job, you have to take a job where it pays way less, it's not a big deal, right? Because you've already been living way below your means. But when you're paycheck to paycheck, making good money, and then you lose a good job and you got to go down to a job that's making a lot less than that, you're in trouble, especially if your paycheck to paycheck living is because of debt. And these aren't things you can just cut out. They're not discretionary things. When you've got car loans and a big house loan and student loans and credit cards and all this stuff, there's no trimming the belt. I mean, that's it. Those payments have to go out, right? But if you've done it the right way and you don't have any debt and you've been saving a bunch of money and living below your means and you get a big pay cut, big deal, right? Big deal. You just can't save as much, that's all. This is the millionaire mindset. All right, rule number 7. This is the last rule, and then I have just one other pet peeve of mine that I'm going to talk about before I get to Ramsey's stuff. Rule number 7, this one's very important. Get on the same page with your spouse and manage money together. Get on the same page with your spouse and manage money together. You will probably never get ahead if you're not on the same page with your spouse. It's very important for spouses to be on the same page about money and the same page on everything as much as possible. And this is biblical. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. And I have some quotes here from the Millionaire Next Door, which his research showed the exact same thing, and Ramsey likewise. All of his experience and research has showed the exact same thing. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. It says, "Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them, that is your wives, according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered." Dwell together according to knowledge. So you know your wife, you understand your wife, and you each dwell according to knowledge. You both know your financial situation. You both know your budget. You both know what money is being spent in the household. And being heirs together, there's that word again, together according to the grace of life. Being heirs together of the grace of life. So husbands and wives ought to be together on everything, especially in finances. If you are not, it will be very difficult or even impossible to build wealth. Here's a quote from Thomas J. Stanley in The Millionaire Next Door. He said, "Most people will never become wealthy in one generation if they are married to people who are wasteful. A couple cannot accumulate wealth if one of its members is a hyper-consumer. This is especially true when one or both are trying to build a successful business. Few people can sustain profligate spending habits and simultaneously build wealth." That's very true, unless you make a fortune. And even if you make a fortune, you probably still won't become wealthy if you have profligate spending. And then he goes on to say later on in the book, "It is very difficult for a married couple to accumulate wealth if one is a spendthrift," meaning that person, thrift is what's left over. You spend the thrift, right? You're a spendthrift. You spend everything, in other words. "A household divided in its financial orientation is unlikely to accumulate significant wealth." Just like Jesus said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. A house divided against itself financially cannot stand. It won't. It will not do well. One spouse could be the embodiment of Dave Ramsey himself. If the other one is a spendthrift, it's going to be a major, major challenge. When looking for a spouse, this should be one of our highest priorities, because it is the one thing that causes more marital trouble and strife than anything else. Money and sex are the two big ones. But money. Money fights are the biggest reason for divorce, I've read. And this is what causes more problems in marriage than anything else. It's good to get off on the right foot. If you don't get off on the right foot, it's hard to correct the path. If you start off on a journey going in the wrong direction, until you get the car turned around, you're not going to get where you want to go, right? So it's good to start off on the right foot. Now, if you're not like-minded about money, I recommend having a family meeting about money. And this would go regardless of who's the financially responsible one and who's not, whether it's the husband or the wife. Have a family meeting. If you can't have a family meeting about this, you need to go to marriage counseling. Whether you're the wife or the husband, whoever wants and thinks you need to have the family meeting, if you can't have this family meeting because you're too afraid to mention it, the other one's going to get mad or whatever, you need to go to counseling. You have severe problems. The marriage partner who is more financially responsible should suggest to the other partner that they get together and put a budget together that they both agree to, and then stick to it. And that's the key to it. If you have the responsible partner saying, "Okay, I made this budget, this is what we're going to live on," and the irresponsible one's just like, "Nah, I don't feel like doing that." You know, your budget's worthless. It's a paper tiger. You need to get together. You need to create a budget together. You need to have one bank account, shared finances. And some people are afraid of this. A couple is virtually never going to get ahead with separate bank accounts, separate finances, his money, her money, she pays this, he pays this. That is a recipe for disaster. And I would not recommend it except in just the worst of circumstances. If you're married to an addict or something, if you're married to a gambler, if you're married to an alcoholic, you're married to a drug addict or something like that, in that severe circumstance, yes, separate out the money. But other than that, you should have shared finances. It's called a marriage for a reason. The two are one. Having separate bank accounts is nuts. It doesn't make any bit of sense. So you get together, you make a budget, a monthly budget. You do this at the beginning of every month because your budget might change. You might, you know, want to spend money on a certain thing this month or save money for a certain thing this month, and then next month there'll be a different focus or something. So you do that. And when you create the monthly budget together and you agree on this together, now we both have agreed. And if you go over in this area, well, you're wrong and you need to repent, like, because we both agreed to this. Now, if the husband is financially responsible and the wife is an uncontrolled spender and will not change her ways, it is a bit of an easier situation because the husband can just tell his wife that they are going to live by a budget, cut up her credit cards and debit cards, give her an allotted amount of cash each month for groceries, household items, clothes, etc., and this will limit her profligate spending. Now, some people might say, that's ridiculous. But you know what I say? If she I'm talking about a woman who will not change her ways. If she insists on acting like a child, treat her like a child. Now, you might say, that sounds like you're a chauvinist. And I say, ask me if I care. Ask me if I care. I'm only talking about a wife who will not reform her ways after you've asked and been nice about it. And you know what? She keeps blowing money. Cut the cards up, credit cards, debit cards, and you give her cash like you would a little child. You give an allowance. Here you go, honey. Here's your allowance. Here's your cash. You don't have access to the bank accounts anymore because you can't be trusted, right? She acts like a child. Treat her like one. That's what I say. Or you could not do that and keep going broke. I don't know. I would recommend going to marriage counseling, though. If you need to do that with your wife, you need to go to marriage counseling big time. Now, if the husband is the irresponsible one, God help you. God help you. Because if the wife's the irresponsible one, the husband is the head of the wife, and he can say, this is how it's going to be. He's the head. If he's the irresponsible one, the wife can't say, this is the way it's going to be. The wife is in a very delicate situation. I would say to a woman in that situation, try your best to meekly and gently persuade him to make a budget with you and live by it. 1 Peter 3:1-2. Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. So yes, do it meekly. Meekly and gently. Just tell him, like, honey, I'm scared to death. Our finances are a mess. We're broke. We're going to die in poverty. This terrifies me. Please, please help me with this. If things are really bad, you could ask him to go to Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University with you, and they offer it here in town every year. You could ask him to do that. And you may also need, and you do need, to go to a marriage counselor. I would highly recommend that. You need to go to marriage counseling if that's the problem. Here's Dave Ramsey's advice on this. This is from his book, Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money. Thought he had some good thoughts. So what are you supposed to do? First and foremost, you simply need to talk to your spouse. You didn't marry a mind reader, so don't expect your mate to immediately be on the same page with you if you haven't told him or her what page you're on. If they haven't picked up this book or gone to an FPU, that's Financial Peace University, class with you yet, just sit them down and explain why you're so excited about what you're learning. Share the dreams and hopes you have for your family's money situation. Sometimes one spouse's passion and excitement is all it takes to get the other spouse excited too. If that's not enough to move the conversation forward, you're going to need to try a little harder. Take the time to write out exactly what you're concerned about in your current financial plan and how you believe life could be different for your family if both spouses were engaged in the process. Sometimes the written word will get a spouse's attention more than a conversation, and that's absolutely true. You could also try the Valentine's approach. Quote, honey, The most romantic thing you could do for me is to sit down and work on a budget with me. On a scale of 1 to 10, dinner and a movie is a 3, but working together to get out of debt is a 9. And I will add, and we have no money for dinner and a movie anyway. Right? Just my commentary. Or the security approach. Quote, sweetie, what do you think it'd feel like if we had $10,000 in the bank just for emergencies? Can you even imagine that? Just get creative. Your spouse is your partner for life, so make sure he or she knows how important this is to you and how much you need him or her on board with you. He continues, I think this is from the same book later on. He said, couples who actually agree on and live according to a written plan will automatically remove many of the money fights that plague so many marriages. Don't get me wrong, though. Working on a budget together can actually cause a lot of marriage fights. So don't forget what we talked about in the last chapter. If you want to know what he talked about in the last chapter, go get the book and read it. I recommend it. Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money. Read that after you read the Total Money Makeover. But long term, if you and your spouse work together on this money stuff, you're doing more than managing your income. You're coming together to agree on your goals, dreams, and priorities. I've heard from couples a million times that actually working on their finances saved their marriages. That's because it's not just about money. This is powerful stuff, and it has the power to create unity in your marriage. Don't miss that incredible opportunity. I think he's absolutely right. He'd know about it more than I do. He's dealt with this for 30 years. He's talked to thousands and thousands of people. He's seen it happen. So it's not, like he said, it's not just about money. Money touches on every single area of life. There is no area of life that money doesn't touch on. Think about anything you want to do, anywhere you want to go, anything you want to buy, everything touches on money. So if you get on the same page with your spouse about money, you're going to be on the same page about a lot of stuff. All right, now I have that one more thing I was telling you about before I get to Ramsey's baby steps. And this isn't so much a rule. I mean, I guess you could kind of say it's a rule in a roundabout way. But this is more of just a pet peeve of mine. I haven't heard this for a while, probably because the tax code has changed and the standard deduction now under Trump, when Trump did his tax cuts here back in 2017, I think. The standard deduction now is almost 30 grand. So most people, it probably doesn't make financial sense to write off the interest on their mortgage. They would just take the standard deduction. They wouldn't itemize. I haven't even told you what the stupid thing is, I guess. Let me tell you what the stupid thing is first. Taking out a 30-year mortgage so that you can write off the interest on your taxes is stupid. Okay? That is dumb. Yes, it is one of the many dumbest things you could possibly do. Okay, there are many of them. It's stupid. And I will explain why it's stupid. But for one thing, it's exceedingly stupid because you're probably not writing off the interest anyway now, like I said, because the standard deduction is so high that, you know, most people wouldn't be doing that. But even if you were itemizing and you could write off the interest on your mortgage, if you think, I'll take out a 30-year mortgage instead of a 15 so I can write off the interest, that is the dumbest thing ever. Only an idiot would spend a dollar to save 30 cents. That's what you're doing. If you take out a 30-year mortgage so you have a bunch of interest that you pay so that you can get a tax write-off, you are spending a dollar to save 30 cents. You're stepping over dollars to pick up quarters, as they say. I imagine you know this. Maybe you don't. A lot of people don't. Did you know that you don't get back all the interest that you paid on your mortgage in your taxes? You don't get back any expense that you are able to expense on your taxes. You don't get back all that money. It's not some kind of a tax credit or something like that. I don't think most people, even some self-employed people, some business people, don't even understand this. I told you one time that I was when a company that I used to work for, we had an independent contractor there, and she took a bunch of us out to lunch, and she's like, yeah, I needed a tax write-off anyway. I'm like, that's the dumbest thing in the world. You're going to spend $100 so you can save 25. Especially now, the tax, not probably nobody would care about this, but when the tax system was reformed here a few years ago, now meals are only 50% deductible anyway. So they used to be 100%, now they're only 50% deductible. But even when they were 100%, it does not make sense to spend 100 to save 25 or 30. you simply just don't pay the income tax on the amount that you paid in interest. So, for instance, if you paid your banker master $1,000 a year in interest, which you probably paid a lot more than that, especially in the beginning of your loan, like way more than that, but I'll just use $1,000 as an example. So you paid your banker master $1,000 in interest, and now you don't have to pay the government 30% of that $1,000 in income tax. That's how it works. You don't pay 30% of the $1,000 in tax. So you paid $1,000 in interest to your banker master, and you saved yourself $300 in taxes for a net loss of $700. Okay. If you would have paid $0 in interest to your banker master and paid $300 to the government, you would only have a net loss of $300. So you chose to lose $700 instead of lose $300. It doesn't make any financial sense to spend $1,000 to save $300. If you don't agree with me, then I have a deal for you. You give me $1,000, I'll give you $300 back. And we can do this every day, multiple times a day. As a matter of fact, if that's not a good enough deal for you, let's up it a little bit. Give me $10,000, I'll give you $3,000. You give me $100,000, I'll give you $30,000. You give me $1,000,000, I'll give you $300,000. Whatever. I mean, whatever you want. We can do this as many times as you want. I've got infinite resources. You know why? Because you're giving me the money first and I'm giving you 30% back. Right? So we can do this forever. If I had not a penny to my name, we could still do this transaction forever and I would soon have a lot of pennies to my name. Yeah. Taking out a 30-year mortgage to write off the interest is insane. All right, let's get now to Dave Ramsey's 7 baby steps. These steps, I believe, are a great system to follow. I've been listening to Ramsey now since before I started this series. I don't remember exactly when I started listening to him regularly, and I read 4 of his books now. And so I'm well acquainted with the 7 baby steps, though I didn't really do the 7 baby steps per se, because I just did things a little differently. But for pretty much everybody, I'd recommend following the baby steps. The thing about the baby steps, though, is that it only works if you'll do it, right? It's not going to work if you don't do it, right? You can look at these and say, yeah, boy, that'd be a great idea, and then not do it. Well, guess what? They're not going to work for you. You actually have to do them if they're going to work. So the first baby step is saving $1,000 fast. This would be if you are in debt and you have nothing saved, or if you have nothing saved, either one. But more than likely, you know, it'd be if you're in debt and you have nothing saved. So the first thing you want to do is save $1,000 fast as possible. This is a mini emergency fund, and it should be done, as I said, as quickly as you can. To do this, you want to create a budget. You want to cut out all unnecessary spending. And you want to have a garage sale if necessary and sell a bunch of stuff you don't need. So you want to cut out all spending and then increase income if you can by selling stuff to get that $1,000 saved up. You want to make minimum payments on all debts until you have the $1,000 saved up. Because if you don't have this mini emergency fund, every little thing that comes along is going to set you back and you're going to be back on credit cards again. So you want this little mini emergency fund set up. And this should not take long. I mean, depending on what your budget is, honestly, most people could probably do this in a month. Probably a lot of people could do this in a paycheck. I mean, literally. People blow so much money. They waste so much money. They could easily cut out $1,000 in a paycheck and have their emergency fund. Maybe a month, maybe two. I mean, whatever. It depends on what your income is. But this should not take long. Do not touch this money, except in the case of an actual emergency. And do not charge another penny of debt on a credit card. That's the key. When you start this process, you have to say, like you're crossing the Rubicon, I will not borrow another dime again ever in my life. I will never swipe a credit card again, ever. If you don't have that attitude, go to sleep. Don't bother listening to this sermon. If you don't have that attitude, you're not going to do the 7 steps. It doesn't matter. Just forget about it. You've got to have that attitude. All right, baby step number 2, start the debt snowball. List your debts, smallest to largest. I've mentioned this a number of times, And I'm just going to give you a bunch of Ramsey quotes to hear it from him. He's the one that came up with it. List them smallest to largest. Here's what he has to say in The Total Money Makeover. He said, the debt snowball method requires you to list all your debts in order of smallest payoff balance to largest. List all your debts except your home. We will get to that in another step. List all your debts, even loans from mom and dad or medical debts that have zero interest. I don't care if there is interest or not. I don't care if some have 24% interest and others 4%. List the debts smallest to largest. If you were so fabulous with math, you wouldn't have debt, so try this my way. And then he says later on in the page, the reason we list smallest to largest is to have some quick wins. Now you want to apply all the extra money that you have each month to the smallest debt while making minimum payments on the rest. So if you have 8 listed out there and you've got credit cards, you've got student loans, you've got a personal loan, you got whatever, you know, your HELOC, your whatever loans that you have, you take them all and you put the smallest one on top and then you list them off, you know, in succeeding order, getting bigger and bigger. And then you, after you've done your budget and you find out I've got X amount per month that I have left over in this budget after my basic needs are met, then 100% of that extra goes on that first debt. 100%. Don't do this debt consolidation thing. I know people have gotten out of debt like this, but what happens is when you do a debt consolidation is, I imagine most people don't follow through with it because it's really hard. If say if you have $50,000 in debt and it's broken up into 10 smaller things that are $5,000 each, we'll just say, it's a lot easier to pay off a $5,000 debt than it is a $50,000 debt. It just takes a lot less time, right? So if you start off and you pay off that first one, and then you get momentum, and then you start paying off the second one, and then you got more momentum, you start paying off the third one, and these things start falling like dominoes, you're going to have all this momentum build up. You're going to have good feedback loop. You're going to have a sense of accomplishment. If you consolidate them all to one $50,000 loan, and I'm paying on this thing for years, and every month it's just month after month after month after month after month, the same amount, and it looks like it's going nowhere, a lot of people are just going to get tired. They're just going to give up. They're just going to quit. All right, that's why you want to do it this way. One thing I didn't mention in here, but Ramsey mentions regularly, if you have savings, you take that savings down to $1,000 and you put all that savings on the debt. So if you have $10,000 in savings and you have $15,000 in debt, you take $9,000 of that dollars, and you pay on that debt. You've got $6,000 left in debt, and you've got $1,000 in savings. And that's what you do. Because again, it's crossing the Rubicon. If you've got that $10,000 in your emergency fund, then you're not quite so serious about it. You're not so worried about it. Some little, you know, if something happens, well, you know, I can just dip into my emergency fund, whatever, and I'll just, you know, pay the debt off later. When you got $1,000, guess what? I'm going to make it work somehow, some way. I'm not going into debt again. And whatever I have to do, whatever it takes, I'm going to do, and I'm going to get this debt paid off. You must declare war on your debt and do so with what Ramsey calls gazelle intensity. That is, running like your life depends on it, because it does. No eating out, no vacations, no unnecessary spending on anything until your debt, except for the mortgage, is all gone. Here's Ramsey again. He says, the major elements of making the debt snowball work are using a budget, getting current before you start, smallest to largest payoff, no cheating, sacrifice, and focused intensity. Total, sold out, focused intensity is possibly the most important. This means saying to yourself and meaning it, to the exclusion of virtually everything else, I am getting out of debt. If you think, this is continuing with his quote, if you think this debt snowball stuff is cute and you might sort of give it a try, it won't work. Total, sold out, focused intensity is required to win. Aiming at the goal and nothing else is the only way to win. You have to know where you're going, and by definition, know where you aren't going, or you will never get there. Now, once you pay off the smallest debt, then all that extra money goes on the next debt. So everything you were paying on that first debt goes on the next debt. And you just keep doing that. You continue the process until all the debts are paid, except for the mortgage. Now, another key to this is you must stop borrowing or you will never get out of debt and stay out of debt. So once you start the debt snowball, you can't borrow anymore. Or what's the point? Here's what Ramsey says. An obvious step to working the debt snowball is to stop borrowing. Otherwise, you will just be changing the names of the creditors on your debt list. So you must draw a line in the sand and say, I will never borrow again. Kind of like what the scripture says, where Job said, if I have sinned, I will do it no more. I forget the exact wording, but when he was repenting, he says, I will do it no more. He's making a vow, a promise, whatever you want to call it. As soon as you make that statement, there will be a test. Trust me, your transmission will go out. Your kid will need braces. It is almost as if God wants to see if you are really gazelle intense. At this point, you are ready for a plastectomy, plastic surgery to cut up your credit cards. A permanent change in your view of debt is your only chance. No matter what happens, you have to pursue the opportunity or solve the challenge without debt. It has to stop. If you think you can get out of debt without huge resolve to stop borrowing, you are wrong. You can't get out of a hole by digging out the bottom. Now, what happens if you have so much debt and so many payments, such a high standard of living, that every penny that you make goes to fund all this and you just really can't get this debt paid off? All you can do is make minimum payments or something like that, where you just really can't get it going. Well, you may need to sell some things. If you can't find money in your budget to pay off all your debts within 18 to 20 months, except the house, then you need to get another part-time job or sell some things. You need to increase income one way or the other. Get a part-time job, get two part-time jobs, whatever you have to do, and sell everything that you can to get the debt snowball rolling. Here's Ramsey again. One way to do that is to sell something. You could sell lots of little stuff at a garage sale, sell a seldom used item on the internet, or sell a big precious item through the classifieds. It shows you this book was written a while ago, the classifieds. Remember those things? Get gazelle intense and sell so much stuff that the kids are afraid they are next. Sell things that make your broke friends question your sanity. If your budget is stopped up and your debt snowball won't roll on its own, you're going to have to get radical. And selling possessions to pay off debt is biblical. Let me give you an example. 2 Kings 4 and verse 7. That's the problem. Most people would rather remain in crushing debt than sell their precious toys and precious stuff and get out. They'd rather remain debt slaves and be miserable for the rest of their lives rather than give up, you know, the fun stuff. 2 Kings 4 and verse 7. You remember Elisha came to this woman and the creditor was ready to come and take her sons away as bondmen, as slaves. She had nothing. And Elijah told her to go borrow some pots and he miraculously filled them up with oil. Then he tells her in verse 7, 2 Kings 4, 7. Then she came and told the man of God and he said, go sell the oil and pay thy debt. And live thou and thy children of the rest. So selling stuff to pay off debt is biblical. This might include selling your precious car, your precious truck, your precious toys. It could even include selling your pets to get out of debt. I don't know how much you get out of your pets, but you'll save yourself a bunch of money every month when you don't have them. I realize that's, most people would think that that's crazy and cruel, but you got to do what you got to do. You lived stupidly, high on the hog, for years of your life. Now it's time to suffer some pain and get things straightened out. Now, Ramsey recommends selling your car or anything else besides your house if you can't pay it off in 18 to 20 months. I think I said 24 months last Sunday. That was from memory. He recommends 18 to 20 months. So basically a year and a half or so. If you can't pay it off, including your car, get rid of it. Sell it. Buy something cheaper. Because it's just going to take you too long. You're going to lose momentum and you're never going to get out of debt. Now, while you're paying off your debts, except your mortgage, using the debt snowball method, you want to postpone retirement savings. Right? So it is not a good idea to say, well, I'm going to keep contributing my 401k and try to get this debt paid off. No, stop contributing your 401k, get the debt paid off, and then get back to contributing to the 401k. Here's what Ramsey says. While you're working your debt snowball, I suggest you temporarily stop all retirement savings, even a 401k that has an employer match. This makes a lot of people nervous, and I understand that. I'm a math nerd, and I know that getting a 100% match, on your contributions is a sweet deal. That's why I want you to get out of debt as fast as possible so you can get back to your investments and really do it with style without worrying about debt payments hanging over your head. Now, if you do that, and when you do that, make sure that you're putting all of the money that you were putting towards retirement towards your debt. Because I know what people do. I was contributing $500 a month to my IRA or to my IRA or 401k or whatever. Okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to get out of debt. And now, well, I got $500. Well, I really need this. I really need that. I really need that. I'm going to end up putting $100 towards your debt and blowing the other $400. Right? You put 100% of that, all $500 in that case, toward the debt. You don't spend a penny of it. All right, baby step number three. This is to finish the emergency fund. So once you pay off the debt, you want to put all the extra money in your budget toward fully funding your emergency fund. So all that money that was going towards debt, and you were gazelle intense, you were going scorched earth on it, all of that money, you don't lighten up one bit. You don't take your foot off the accelerator one inch. Every penny of that you were paying off debt with goes into an emergency fund now to get a fully funded 3 to 6 month emergency fund. The 3 to 6 months is of living expenses, not income, as I talked about last Sunday. I recommend having 6 months of living expenses at least in your emergency fund. And eventually, when you get to the point, like I mentioned last Sunday, I recommend, basically, I think an emergency fund really should only be in the case that you lose your job. I don't think, personally, emergency fund is not for when your dryer blows up, when your car breaks down, you ought to have a car fund for that, you ought to have a house fund for that, you ought to have funds for all the rest of the stuff, and then just be able to cash flow it out of your paycheck each couple of weeks. I think personally the emergency fund is only if you lose your job and that's what you live off of until you get another job. But that's up to you, however you want to do it. This fund should only be used for true emergencies. It should be liquid, as I mentioned last Sunday, meaning that it's in a savings account or a money market account that you can have quick access to. The emergency fund is often more important to women than it is to men because they desire security and safety. So often more important to women. So I say men, act like men and make sure you have a fully funded emergency fund for your wife's sake and for your own sake, for both of your sakes, but especially for her sake. Men don't think like women, so you might not understand how she feels, but if she's a normal woman, she probably seeks that safety and security of having a fully funded emergency fund that she doesn't have to worry if something happens. Here's what Ramsey said in Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money. Men, for example, use money like a scoreboard and lose self-esteem when money problems pop up. Women, on the other hand, experience fear. My wife actually says terror when money problems come up, because money represents security to them. This is why guys usually resist saving up 3 to 6 months of expenses as an emergency fund. Just having that much money sitting around doing nothing seems like a waste to men, but their wives will likely tell you it's the most important key to their financial plan. And it just makes good sense, especially to somebody who's wired like me. I do not live life on the edge in any way, pretty much. I like having lots of padding. Even as a pastor, if I only had this week's sermon in my folder of sermons to do, and that's all I had, and I didn't know what I was going to preach on next week, I'd have a nervous breakdown. I mean, my goodness, I've got to have 2 or 3 months of sermons laid up in there, in well off into the future, and then I'm comfortable. That's just me. Some pastors are different. And there's nothing wrong with that. And maybe, you know, there are benefits to the other way too, because they're actually like thinking about their sermon, working on their sermon all week long that they're going to preach on Sunday. Whereas me, I probably did it 3 months ago and I'm going to pull it out and review it a couple of times before, you know, Sunday comes around. Different strokes for different folks. One thing you don't want to do is buy a house before you have a fully funded emergency fund. And a lot of people make this mistake. A lot of people jump into home ownership way before they're ready. They're in debt already and they've got no emergency fund. They are just asking for a disaster waiting to happen. Here's what Ramsey has to say. He says, I love real estate, but do not buy a home until you finish this step. That is the emergency fund step. A home is a blessing, but if you move into home ownership with debt and no emergency fund, Murphy will set up residence in the spare bedroom. I believe in the financial and emotional advantages of home ownership, but I have known many stressed out young couples who rushed to buy something before they were ready. Saving for a down payment or cash purchase of a home should occur after becoming debt free in step 2 and after finishing the emergency fund in step 3. That makes saving for a down payment baby step 3B. You should save for the home. If you have the itch before moving on to the next step. Many people are worried about getting a home, but please let it be a blessing rather than a curse. It will be a curse if you buy something while you're still broke. There are all sorts of folks who are eager to, quote, work with you, unquote, so that you can make it happen sooner. But the definition of, quote, creative financing, unquote, is, quote, too broke to buy a house, unquote. Yeah, any clown that wants to work with you when it comes to buying a house or buying a car or buying anything, if he wants to work with you, run! He wants to get you in debt. He wants to get you in slavery is what work with you means. Forget about that. All right, here's another quote from Ramsey on this, his complete guide to money. If you don't have $200,000 in the bank to pay cash for a house today, that's okay. You've got time. Even if you never pay cash for a house, you still need to only buy when you're ready. How do we define ready? Let's look at the baby steps. If you are not out of debt and don't have a full emergency fund of 3 to 6 months worth of expenses, you aren't ready to buy a house. Buying a house when you can't afford it is one of the best ways to ruin your life. Homeownership brings with it a ton of risk, from faulty water heaters to a bad roof. If you don't have savings to cover this stuff, you'll be running back to credit cards and equity loans when something, quote, unexpected, unquote, comes up. I didn't mention this. I'm going to keep reading the quote here in a second. I didn't mention this in this section because I mentioned it last time. But also, in order to be ready, is that you can finance that house on a 15-year mortgage with no more than 25% of your take-home pay, and that you have enough in your budget to save 15% of your gross income for retirement. Because you're going to have that house for, if you're on a 15-year mortgage, you're going to have that house loan for 15 years or maybe another 10 or 12 or something. And you want to be saving for retirement during that time. You certainly don't want to put off saving for retirement until, you know, you get your house paid off and you're way behind the eight ball then. So anyway, that would be a couple of other stipulations that I haven't mentioned here and Ramsey didn't mention in these quotes anyway. Let me continue. If you're working the debt snowball or haven't finished your emergency fund, you should rent. There is absolutely nothing wrong with renting for a little while. People will tell you, rent? No way. That's just flushing money down the toilet. I think I thoroughly dispensed that notion last Sunday. It's better to own, they say. No, it's not. Broke people should not buy houses. That's a recipe for disaster. The money you pay in rent while you're cleaning up your debt and saving up your emergency fund and down payment demonstrates patience. Look, I don't want you renting forever as a way of life. I just want you to be ready before you buy. Make a goal to hit baby step 3 and then save a big down payment as quickly as possible. I love home ownership, but it will kill you if you're not ready for it. And the other thing to remember with regards to this is you don't ever want to take out a home equity loan, especially in place of an emergency fund. Some people think that I don't really need a home, I don't need an emergency fund because I can get a home equity loan anytime, and I can just borrow money against the house and then I can, you know, take care of any emergency that happens. That's a really bad idea. Here's what Ramsey says. The home equity loan is one of the most aggressively marketed loans today. The average American is in debt to his eyeballs and exhausted all means of borrowing except the big second mortgage on his home. This is very sad because we now put our homes at risk to go on vacation, open a business, consolidate debt, or just for an emergency fund. Families come to us in dire straits when the home equity loan is their last bad mistake and the straw that breaks the camel's back. All right, one more step for today, and then we'll take care of the rest of them next Sunday, Lord willing. And that is baby step four. Invest 15% of your household income in retirement. You want to invest, and I know I've said this before, I'm going to keep saying it because I want to drill it into you. You want to invest 15% of your gross income, that's before taxes. I'm not talking about your take-home pay, I'm talking about what you actually make before taxes. Invest 15% of that in tax-advantaged retirement accounts like 401ks, traditional IRAs, or Roth IRAs. You can see the prior section on investing for the details, and I talked about different investment strategies and different types of accounts and those sorts of things. But you want to remember, you want to take the match first, do the 401k up until the point you can get the match, fill up you and your spouse's Roth IRAs, which is after-tax money, and it grows tax-free, so you never pay another dime of taxes on it ever. And then if you need more after that, go back to the 401k and put the remainder of the 15% in there. Here's what Ramsey says. Once we have covered these basic steps and laid a foundation, the time has come to build some wealth. Remember, that is why we started a total money makeover. We wanted not just to be out of debt, but to become wealthy enough to give, retire with dignity, leave an inheritance, and have some expensive fun. You need to reach the point where your money works harder than you do, he said later. That's the key. That's when you've made it. When your money works harder than you do. When your money makes more money than you do. In other words, when your investments produce more income than your job does. That's when you've made it. That's when you can live off your investments. And you theoretically wouldn't need to work anymore if you couldn't or didn't want to. Now, most people in this country are not prepared for retirement. This was written in 2007. This is from the Total Money Makeover. I think I have too many iBids in there in the quotes, because the iBids, if you follow them back up, go to the Complete Guide to Money. But I believe this last quote that I read you was actually from the Total Money Makeover. This one probably is too. But anyway, just get both of the books and look up page 154 in both of them, and you'll find whichever one it was. All right, here's what Ramsey had to say. USA Today reports that out of 100 people age 65, 97 of them can't write a check for $600. What he's saying is 97% of people 65 and older, at least back in 2007, couldn't write a check for $600. That is crazy. Crazy. 54 are still working, so 54% of them are still working. You know what this tells me? 97% of them need to still be working. If you can't write out a $600 check, you need to get to work. My goodness. What are these people going to do? Run up credit cards, I guess. I don't know what they're going to do. And 3 are financially secure. That's 3%. 3% of 65-year-olds back in 2007 were financially secure. That's a bad state of affairs. Bankruptcies among those 65 and older have gone up 164% in the last 8 years. Like I said, this is written a long time, almost 20 years ago. Getting older is going to happen. You must invest now if you want to spend your golden years in dignity. Investing with the long-term goal of security is not a theory to ponder every few years. It is a necessity you must act on now. you must actually fill out the paperwork for your mutual fund. You must actually put money in that thing. According to these statistics, the level of denial the average person has on this subject is alarming. And I gave you more statistics quite some time ago, a few months ago probably, in this series with how bad the retirement situation is in this country. You do not want to rely on socialist insecurity for your retirement. Now, I've told you this. Here's what Ramsey has to say about this. By the same token, do not use your potential Social Security benefits in your calculations. That is, in your retirement calculations when you're young, figuring out how much money you're going to need. Forget about socialist insecurity. Just imagine it won't be there, because it probably won't. And even if it is, don't plan on it. I don't count on an inept government for my dignity at retirement, and you shouldn't either. A recent survey said more people, this is funny, a recent survey said more people under age 30 believe in flying saucers than believe they will receive a dime from social insecurity. Which, that wouldn't surprise me. I know that when I was 30, I didn't believe in flying saucers, but I think there's a much more of a chance of me seeing one come and land in my yard than there is of me getting a dime of Social Security, that's for sure. I tend to agree. I'm not taking a political position, although I'm not above it. But the mathematics of that system spell doom. I'm not Chicken Little predicting the sky is falling. Entire books have been written on the Social Security mess. Understand, it is your job to take care of you and yours. So part of your total money makeover is to invest now to make that happen. If Social Security isn't there when you retire, you'll be glad you listened to my advice. If by some miracle Social Security is there when you retire, that will mean I was wrong. In that case, you'll have some extra money to give away. I'm sure you'll forgive me for that. And I will end this sermon, which not too bad. I got through it all in a little less than an hour. I'll end this sermon reminding you that anyone can become wealthy by investing 15% of his gross income from a young age. Anyone. There is no person in this country, if you have any kind of a decent job over minimum wage, probably, and even if you start off with a minimum wage job, you're not going to end there. So I would virtually say anybody that works a full-time job who starts investing 15% of his gross income from a young age, and I mean anyone, will be a millionaire by the time he retires. Anyone. Here's what Ramsey says. If a young couple really got this message in their 20s and took a few years to get out of debt and save up a full emergency fund, they could start investing 15% of their income from age 30 on. Even if they only had a household income of $40,000, they could be looking at more than $5 million at age 70 just by faithfully investing 15% every month. And that's if they never got a raise, which is, of course, very unlikely. I've said it before, there's no excuse for anyone to retire broke in America. These opportunities are available to everyone no matter when you get started. All it takes is some discipline and attention to a few simple concepts, and anyone can become a millionaire, totally change their family tree, and leave an incredible legacy of generous giving. So go do it, he says. Now, I will tell you about a much faster way to accomplish this after the sermon next week, Lord willing. But that's going to be after the sermon. And no, it's not Bitcoin or crypto or anything like that. But I'll keep you waiting for that one until after the sermon next week. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention again.